Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. In this podcast, Dr. David Solomon, a leading expert in the treatment of higher-risk myelodysplastic neoplasms, or HRMDS, discusses the impact that emerging treatment options may have on clinical practice. He first covers the latest updates to the classification of HRMDS. He then outlines the mode of action of emerging therapeutic agents and discusses clinical evidence on their efficacy and safety. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Gilead Sciences, Inc. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
So welcome to this exciting discussion of novel treatments for higher risk MDS, what's on the horizon with Touch Oncology. My name is Dr. David Solomon. I'm the myeloid section head at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you this morning. So the definition of MDS, again, this has not really changed. I think one important feature is although the initials have stayed the same MDS, we now call it myelodysplastic neoplasm versus syndrome. And I think the important part is when you're discussing this with your patients, this is a bone marrow malignancy of the blood and bone marrow. This is not a syndrome. This has prognosis is in some setting as low as 6 months, argue worse than many metastatic cancers, although there's a huge spectrum of disease. There are some patients I never treat, follow them for decades. So how is the diagnosis established? There's really two features. You have your blood counts, but then you get a bone marrow aspiration and a bone marrow biopsy. Really, the aspiration is most important. This is really where you look at, is a cell dysplastic or not, needing more than 10% in a lineage to call it. And this is the best and most accurate enumeration of blast percentage, which matters, again, are you, you know, into the higher risk versus lower risk, MDS versus AML. This should really come from the aspirin. But sometimes you don't get it. And in all patients, at least in the US, we do get a core biopsy. You could do CD34 staining to help evaluate if you what your blast count is if the aspirin is not reflective. And then you could also characterize the bone marrow cellularity. Most of these patients are hypercellular. So how do we think about prognosis? Again, one critical feature of today is we have to know who's higher risk in order to be able to treat them as higher risk. And I think this is evolving. We clearly have much better ways to prognosticate patients, but truly which patients we should treat as higher risk MDS, I think we're going to still continue to learn more. And this is really going to be something cutting edge within the field. So we had the IPSS, then we had the IPSSR, and now we have the IPSSM. Essentially what these account for is what's the blast percentage, how low are the blood counts, so you get more points the blood counts are lower, and what are the cytogenetic abnormalities? There's tables available online, easy to sort of find that cytogenetic risk category, and then you know, sort of add that, at least from the IPSSR system. But now we're starting to incorporate mutations. So no question, standard of care, NCCN, ELN, 100% of patients that have MDS require next-gen sequencing. This is absolutely critical from prognosis, is changing our treatment, is gonna guide clinical trials in the future. So we really have to put all of these things together. So again, what is MDS, what is AML? We used to have 30% blast cutoff, then 20% blast cutoff, and I'm gonna talk in a moment about even some changes. So as that blast count goes up, you know, should we be thinking about these patients differently? Somebody that's 19% and is MDS, somebody that's 20% and is AML, those are the same patient. Really what's probably most important is what is the molecular subset within those patient groups. So I quite strongly argue if you have a 5% blast or higher and you're P53 mutant, we should think about MDS and AML as one disease. This has actually been shown by multiple groups and really needs to be incorporated when we think about drug approvals, clinical trial design. If you're more than 5% in P53, you're really one disease. But this may be very different with other subsets of patients. So again, just thinking about this a little bit more, there have been now updated recommendations, and I really refer you to some of these publications on the bottom, with this 10 to 90% blast cutoff, at least based on ICC classification, being called MDS slash AML. And I think the importance, again, is just thinking about this group together, both clearly on trial. Actually, many trials include this group of patients together, particularly European-based trials right now. But even in my standard of care practice, so an MDS EB2 patient, I may very much think about incorporation of venetoclax with subgroups of patients based on having much higher response rates with that combination. But we still have a lot to learn. But this blast cutoff is again, heterogeneous. So what were the changes from the IPSSR to the IPSSM? No change in really blood counts, no change in cytogenetic risk or blast counts. The key is we now have age, but really the addition of mutations based on these comprehensive panels 40 to 100 genes being most of them. So the key is there's 16 prognostic genes, essentially each one of those being adverse, essentially giving you more risk, with the exception of SF3B1, which gives you good risk. And then there's another group of 15 genes really to give what are the total number of mutations that these patients have. Essentially, the more mutations have, the worse your prognosis is. And then lastly is the P53 allelic status. You'll hear this as monoallelic, biallelic, or single hit or multi-hit. These are really semantics of the same thing. I like to make it, it's a little bit complicated, but to break it down, if you have two mutations of P53, if you have a mutation with some alteration of 17, or if you have a variant allele frequency, which is the clonal burden, those are the P53 multi-hit, the really bad of the bad. So again, what does it allow us to do? So I highly recommend you click on this calculator. It's very easy to use. There's essentially three different pages that you add all these variables to. And what's nice, you say, hey, I don't have every gene that's on this list. It allows you to say that I didn't assess it. And so this missingness was validated both in the key publication in New England Journal of Evidence, as well as multiple publications at ASH of 2022 showing real world proof that this is a calculator and a system that allows a refinement of prognosis both for overall survival, as well as what the risk of changing to leukemia. I think the big question is now if a patient is reclassified as higher risk, do we automatically treat them as higher risk? I don't think it's a one size fits all, but we should definitely be thinking about those patients. And if you have a patient very much on the borderline, but clearly molecularly higher risk, I think we should treat them as such at this time, particularly in the setting of clinical trial. So again, you get this relative risk, very high being the worst overall survival, very low being the best. Also predicts the risk overall, again, of leukemic transformation. And again, it has really a set. You can, in front of your patient, do this and provide very real-world data for the patient. Although I always caveat that, right? They're one patient. This is over 3,000 patients. So every patient can behave a little bit differently, but it really allows a little bit of a more personalized discussion. So what are our priorities of therapy? So I think the table, again, we're modifying the disease course. We're trying to limit disease progression. Of course, our goal is to improve survival. But really the goal for most of our patients is, can we improve their quality of life? And how do we do this? This is by improving their blood counts, particularly if we can make them transfusion free from a hemoglobin perspective, taking them out of the mortality risk, which is a really tightly concordant with the neutropenia particularly, and also thrombocytopenia from a bleeding perspective. But when we think about who is higher risk, if you are high risk or very high risk, you have a median survival of 1 to 1.7 years. Really, all higher risk patients have a median survival less than 2 years, very few having outcomes greater than 5 years. So number one, two, and three are clinical trial. And then we're going to talk about, again, what are the outcomes of the data? How can we potentially improve the outcomes in this patient group? So what are our therapeutic options? So essentially, if you're not a candidate for transplant, we have one therapy. You have hypomethylating agent, 7-day azacitidine, 5-day decitabine. These are really our gold standards. And really our goal is hematologic improvement. If we can make this better, this decreases the morbidity and mortality and is really our goal for this group. One very important feature is these patients need at least 6 cycles of therapy. Stopping early is definitely a mistake because even out to 9 cycles, patients who have stable disease, about 20% of that group will further improve their response. And as there is no option number two that's currently FDA approved, keeping them on outside of very overt progression is really a key feature of this management. When you look at the candidates for transplant, it's a little bit more complicated. So I think in patients without an increase in blast, you have an option of either going direct to transplant or HMA-based therapy. Again, highly favor HMA-based clinical trial. You could actually argue strongly to take some of these patients direct to transplant, although real world, the vast majority of these patients do get HMA therapy. And that's because they really have severely low blood counts and people are trying to get their blood counts up quicker. In younger patient populations with higher blast, again, you have clinical trial, HMA therapy, but now we also have intensive therapy. And based on some molecular subsets, you know, that could be an option and a consideration. But ultimately, no matter what, transplant is key. So the day I sort of make their diagnosis for a high risk is the day I refer for allogeneic transplant. We have to do these things in parallel, either taking them direct to transplant or taking them to the transplant when both their functional status has improved as well as their blood counts and ideally being in complete remission. So where are the supportive data for transplant? Really, this key publication is really number two, where patients up to 75 years of age had significant improvement in overall survival, a dramatic improvement of this sort of long-term outcomes. And really, why is that? If you just have HMA therapy alone, less than half of these patients are going to respond. And the median duration of response is 1 year. And we already talked about their survival is less than 2 years. So if their goal is long-term survival, and this is a key discussion with patients, very personalized, there's no question that transplant needs to be incorporated into their care, including in the setting of clinical trials. So then again, we're going to just talk very briefly on some of the mechanisms of action of these agents. And again, this is sort of the totality of what we're going to talk about today, but I'm going to go very briefly into each of these ones specifically. So venetoclax is a BCL2 inhibitor, which essentially blocks this anti-apoptotic protein BCL2, allows these cancer cells to die. And we're going to talk in more detail about how this works in the future. Next is immune therapy. So although traditional immune checkpoints such as, you know, PD-1 inhibitors have not improved outcomes, even in randomized trials have not, we have magrolimab and sabatolimab, both drugs augmenting the immune system. Magrolimab doing this through activation of macrophage-mediated phagocytosis, and sabatolimab doing this by blocking a negative immune checkpoint on T cells. Actually, both may also target the leukemic stem cell directly. Additionally, you know, can we have targeted inhibitors? I would love to have more of these. This is big in clinical trial right now, but the only ones out there, you know, ivosidenib and asciminib, clearly, actually, the data, they respond just as well, if not better. I argue that we should be moving a lot of these drugs early in MDS patients, but we have to do that in the setting of clinical trial. And then we have one agent to date that has been extensively tested in P53. Again, the one important part, this is with epranetapop or APR246, is we really have to run P53 trials by themselves, because it's a patient group that we should not be lumping into sort of all of their settings. Pevonedistat is a NED8 inhibitor. This is essentially a complex mechanism of action, but allows this accumulation of protein substrates, which essentially causes the cancer cell to die. And then tamibarotene. So this is a RARA agonist. So it binds RARA, and about half of patients have overexpression of this pathway. And by agonist effect, it allows these cancer cells to differentiate into more normal cells. It's the only agent that has a currently accruing phase 3 trial. The three other pivotal ones that you know, we've talked about and we're going to discuss in detail have fully accrued their studies. So again, in summary, I think there's challenging in classification, but now we can give a much better refinement of prognosis. This is specifically with incorporation of mutations, utilization of the IPSSM. We're now much better able to stratify these patients, but how we impact this into which patients should get HMA therapy or not, I think we're still learning. But essentially, HMA is our standard of care. It's an inadequate standard of care. Clinical trial is really most important in an early referral to transplant. Now we're going to talk about efficacy data for some really exciting emerging therapies for patients with higher risk MDS. Again, our last approval was 2006. We're really quite desperate and urgently and excitingly waiting, again, the next therapies to improve outcomes in our patient population. So first, going to talk about venetoclax. Again, this is a BCL2 inhibitor. This essentially tips that balance from of pro-apoptosis, anti-apoptosis. And by blocking it, it allows these cells to die. The key is venetoclax by itself, not much activity. You have to add it with another therapy that, again, is a cytotoxic or an agent that induces apoptosis. It's really the two together that are synergistic, not one separately. So really where this has been a paradigm shift is HMA venetoclax is the new standard of care for our elderly AML patients. But I think as you've just learned, there's a huge overlap. So 10 to 19% blast is that AML. A lot of these patients may better respond to these type of therapies, faster responses, quicker count recovery, and this is now being extensively studied in higher risk MDS patients. So what's the clinical trial? So we have really a quite large phase 1 clinical trial that has been ongoing and now presented at multiple meetings, essentially included higher risk MDS patients, intermediate or higher, no previous therapy for MDS, had to have less than that 20% blast cutoff, CMML patients were excluded, and typically therapy-related patients excluded as well. If you look at what was the outcomes of therapy, again, you can see that CR rates were quite reasonable, over 30%. That with marrow remissions, actually response rates were over, you know, around 80%. And these responses appeared, you know, to be quite durable. Again, looking at this in a little bit more detail, again, 83% of patients responded. And then we started to think about other subsets. So we and others have published that ASXL1 mutations have very low response rates, actually CR rates that are less than 10%. Overall response rate are quite low. And it looks like the addition of venetoclax can overcome that. No difference whatsoever in that ASXL1 mutant. The one thing I caveat on the P53, yes, the overall response rate is quite high, but if you look at the true complete remission rate in this study, it was actually still less than 20%. And I would argue quite identical data to single agent HMA, albeit a lower overall response rate. What may be the most important is what is the durability of those responses, what is the survival, and at least in AML, we really know now that venetoclax has not improved outcomes whatsoever in that patient population, and so I do have concerns for just that specific subset that can be between 10 to 20%, although sometimes 30% in our clinical trials, that does venetoclax improve how these patients are doing. This was another high-risk MDS or CMML phase 1-2 trial that has just recently been published. Again, patients were either HMA naive, or although they did allow a subset of patients with HMA failure, they had a more than 5% bone marrow blast, which is typically required in these studies, and no prior BCL2 inhibitor therapy. You could see about 3/4 of that cohort are HMA naive, 1/4 are HMA failure. Again, quite similar data, you know, so the majority of these patients are responding, and I think intriguingly, even these HMA failure patients are responding. Now, if you look at the median overall survival, you say, oh, it's 13 months in the total population. But again, this is very different if they were naive, where the median overall survival was not met. About 60% of those patients were still alive at data cutoff with a follow-up of around that 1 year timeframe. You know, it looks like that potentially survival is starting to be improved, although critically, there is a randomized phase 3 trial, the Verona trial, to truly answer that question, and that trial has fully accrued. So now moving on to another agent. This is APR246 or epranetapop. Again, this basically binds a mutant P53 protein that's unfolded, restores a more wild type shape to allow it to bind DNA, induce apoptosis, cell cycle arrest, although there are clearly a number of other mechanisms. Again, this was a large phase 1b/2 clinical trial that we ran that included MDS and oligoblastic AML patients. CR was our primary endpoint, and the dose of the epranetapop was IV over 4 days with, again, a standard schedule of azacitidine. When we look at treatment response, again, the vast majority of these patients were responding, whether they were MDS or AML, you know, potentially a little bit of a higher CR rate in the MDS patient population. And the survival looked decent, you know, 11 months, maybe historical 7 to 8 months. And again, this was quite reasonable between both the MDS and AML patient populations. The one big negative is we did complete the phase 3 randomized trial, and unfortunately, CR rates were not improved. They were very close, and I'm hopefully be able to present and publish these data, because this is actually the largest phase 3 and only phase 3 trial that has been run specifically for the P53 mutant group. Again, this is another clinical trial. This was a parallel and a collaboration with the GFM, with all of their French centers. They did allow a little bit of patients with overt AML, but again, mostly high-risk MDS, treatment naive, and oligoblastic AML. Really, otherwise, the clinical trial design was identical. Again, they show very comparable data, majority of patients having response, a true CR rate around 50%, and actually their survival in the MDS patient population was 12 months. So we basically just took the 100 patients on from both of these two clinical trials. I've already talked about the dosing in detail, but what did we see when we looked at the combination? Again, really no difference. Again, the response rates were really quite identical from these two clinical trials. But again, what was maybe the most important is that we had a high degree of this molecular clearance. This was patients clearing at least to less than 5%, with a subset of those patients actually being MRD negative to less than 0.1%. And if you really got that good response, clearly survival was better than not based on landmark analysis. So now moving on to our immune therapies. We're going to talk about sabatolimab, which again, both targets the leukemic stem cell as well as that T cell right there to unleash the adaptive immune system. So again, similar clinical trials, phase 1 clinical trials, relatively large subset. This one only had high and very high risk patients, again, HMA naive. They were allowed to have decitabine or azacitidine, and then sabatolimab, again, is the immune therapy. So what did we see? So you can see that response rate, not that different. So overall response rate, somewhat similar. True CR rate, somewhat similar. But what was exciting, at least in these early data presentations, was the duration of the response. So this led to this randomized phase 2 trial that Dr. Zidane just presented at ASH, actually to me the most important presentation at ASH, which was sabatolimab plus HMA versus placebo plus HMA as a randomized phase 2 trial. You could see, as far as the progression-free survival, which was a primary endpoint of the study, unfortunately was not significant, and the CR rate was also identical. So this is a setback. I think it's concerning, although the phase 3 trial is different. It is an overall survival, solely powered study that is also fully accrued, and again, hopefully the trial can be positive, but this is clearly a setback, as at least in the randomized phase 2, event-free survival was not improved. But were there subsets of patients? So again, patients with lower percentage of blasts appear to have both a better complete remission rate as well as a better progression-free survival. Again, these were sort of approaching or statistically significant in this low, less than 10% blast. But this was a subset that was not pre-specified, and how this would translate to the phase 3 trial is a little bit unclear. So again, there's now this double-blind, placebo-controlled randomized phase 3 trial that is ongoing, and we eagerly await this data, although likely somewhere closer to 2026. So moving on to magrolimab. Again, it's a first-in-class inhibitor targeting CD47 that essentially allows macrophages to eat the cancer cells. So again, this is a cohort of now intermediate to very high-risk patients. Magrolimab is given with this ramp-up schedule from 1 mg per kg to 30 mg per kg. And again, safety, tolerability, and CR rates were our primary endpoints. Again, a high majority of these patients, clearly a higher response rate. It's kind of similar to the venetoclax combinations. True CR rates based on P53 mutant or wild type ranging anywhere between 30 and 40%. So quite encouraging response rates. If we look at progression-free survival, we're now pushing around a year in all subgroups. To me, again, this is maybe about double from what we would expect historically. Granted, this is a single-agent trial, and potentially most exciting was the survival. So our median OS was not reached. Again, it approached sort of that 50% at 2 years, but in the P53 mutant group, a median survival of 16 months appears 6 months better than any prospective or retrospective cohort we've had to date. So just briefly, this is the pivotal clinical trial design of the ENHANCE-1 trial. This has a co-primary endpoint of CR and overall survival. Actually, we're very eagerly awaiting the CR endpoint in the next couple of months and overall survival potentially this next year. This, again, a positive would lead to a new paradigm shift. There are also ENHANCE-2 and 3 trials, which are two AML trials, although one is critical for that P53 mutant patient population that I really think MDS and AML are the same, but we're eagerly awaiting the readout of these trials. They just talk about pevonedistat, again, is a NED8 inhibitor that promotes this sort of cytotoxic protein accumulation in the cancer cell. This was the PANTHER study, which was a phase 3 trial of combination therapy, although it was open label, not placebo controlled, with a primary endpoint of event-free survival. It also included CMML and oligoblastic, so again, a little bit more heterogeneous than the other three pivotal phase 3s that are ongoing. So when we look at event-free survival, clearly there was no difference. Even if we look at the subset of high-risk MDS patients, again, a trend, p-value 0.431, and this has really led to largely discontinuation of this agent, at least at this time, in higher-risk MDS patients. Tamibarotene, again, is really unique. It's a RARA agonist targeting RARA overexpressing patients. This is about 50% of our patient groups, and again, is the only currently accruing double-blind placebo-controlled phase 3 trial. So what data, again, this is that select MDS1 trial. This just shows the makeup of it. They do have to have greater than 5% blast with RARA overexpression. So there's an eligibility challenge. Sometimes that can slow accrual. There's a 2-to-1 randomization currently, azacitidine tamibarotene versus azacitidine placebo. And currently the primary endpoint of the study is complete remission rate. We'll see as far as when this trial will eventually read out. So IDH inhibitors, not enough time to go into detail, but again, ivosidenib and asciminib, response rates really, to me, quite identical, if not a little bit higher than what we're used to in patients with acute myeloid leukemia. We're starting to look at these combinations, which have been now approved in AML, for example, ivosidenib with azacitidine, but we're starting to look at these very small subsets, but response rates, particularly in the naive patient groups, are quite exciting. And lastly, was just a recently approved agent, olutasidenib, which is approved for AML patients, although again, in the subset of patients with high-risk MDS, quite comparable response rates that are appearing durable. Immunotherapy, again, these unfortunately have really failed in high-risk MDS. There have now been several randomized trials, particularly with durvalumab, and these trials have really not seen a major improvement of response rates, trends in some settings, but survival really looks superimposable, including in randomized trials. So in summary, again, I think there are, you know, four key agents right now that we're going to wait on the readout of these key phase three clinical trials. I'm hoping with the new clinical trial design, we'll finally move over the hurdle of many agents such as epranetapopt and pevonedistat that have failed. But clearly, even now into the future, we have to highly favor getting these patients on the right study. I do think we're going to move towards triplet options in the near future, but it's a challenging patient group, but we're optimistic about the future. So now we're going to talk about safety data for some of these emerging therapies. Again, we're really excited about improving response rates, improving survival, especially getting patients to transplant with better outcomes. But we really need to think about the safety. Some of these patients are quite elderly and frail. And especially if we're going to move into, let's say, triplet combinations, which agents may best combine may be largely based on the safety parameters. So again, what are traditional toxicities that we need to consider about? They're really hematologic, gastrointestinal when we think about azacitidine. So the really morbidity, mortality ones are tightly concordant with the neutropenia, the thrombocytopenia, again, mostly for mortality. And then a lot of the morbidity is driven by the degree of anemia. So the lower they are, the more frequent the blood transfusions, the more frequent they need to be at our center, the lower their quality of life is. So improving all those counts, both from safety, making them feel better, preventing infections, preventing bleeding. Those are the key. But unfortunately, these first several cycles of therapy, you can have these drops with standard of care. Actually, maybe up to 20% to 30% of these patients can get admitted to the hospital for neutropenic fevers. The gastrointestinal complications are really quite mild. Mostly is a little bit of nausea that I say nowadays is almost completely eliminated. Constipation is still a real issue, probably again up to 20% of patients. So I have the patient on a good bowel regimen to start, and then we sort of modify based on how the patient is feeling throughout the cycle. So what about venetoclax HMA? So actually very easy, predictable profile. It's really all hematologic. So if you look at this table here for grade 3-4 adverse events, again, I actually find close to 100% of patients get neutropenic. Again, the reason why it's 61% is a lot of patients have grade 4 neutropenia at baseline, and thus you can't get there if you were already there at baseline. But it'll basically be 100% of patients with grade 4. Fortunately, these things are quite transient. Thrombocytopenia in 39%. And again, a subset of these patients having worsening of the anemia. Particularly with cycle one, this is the biggest issue. Again, febrile neutropenia, you can see in the study, occurred 17%. Essentially always requires patients to be admitted to the hospital. And I tell them maybe even up to half of patients may need to be admitted or monitored. Again, predominantly from infections. Usually from a transfusion perspective, we can keep most of these patients as outpatient, although sometimes in the community, they sort of need to tag team this with the hospital. So myeloid suppression is the big issue. This is a first cycle issue predominantly, and we really have to check bone marrow biopsies after the first cycle of therapy, both on and off clinical trials, because if the patients have cleared it, holding all the therapies will allow their good counts to come back up, and then we can tweak it and modify it as we go. Many patients going down to 7 days of venetoclax and ultimately dropping on their azacitidine schedule. So the goal is you get in remission quite rapidly, median time to response of a month, but if you don't tweak it, you will not get this sort of improvement of blood counts, which is critical for our patient population. What about epranetapopt azacitidine? So with this one, really not much worsening of cytopenias, but the big issue is this sort of infusional toxicity that can be nausea and vomiting, clearly higher with this agent than with azacitidine by itself. But with prochlorperazine, we can typically help mitigate that. The other big issue is this sort of infusional neurological toxicity. So it can present as dizziness, changes in feeling, changes in gait, tremors, as sort of shown in this table here. But usually they're isolated to the infusion day. So we can usually treat it, and it usually goes away quite rapidly, or we hold the infusion, and this decreases over time. Actually, few patients will have toxicity, let's say cycle 2, cycle 3, and very rare patients get dose adjusted down, maybe about in that 5 to 10% category. The different in this trial a little bit is, remember, this is the sickest of all sick patients. So P53 mutant patients have worse blood counts. And so when you say, hey, febrile neutropenia is 33%, that's actually comparable even with azacitidine monotherapy in the specific patient population. So it's just important when you think about tox, you need to think about the trial design, the patient groups that were imported, but clearly infectious complications in this group were, which were a major side effect. Really quite identical data with the parallel GFM study. Again, these neurological side effects in total can happen in about 40%, majority being grade 1 or 2, with, again, grade 3 or higher being quite rare, with febrile neutropenia being our most common severe adverse event, again, in almost up to 40% of patients, but again, somewhat reflective of the patient population. So what about immune therapies? Again, our goal is to sort of activate the immune system to attack the cancer cell, but there can be an effect on normal cells as well. We call that immune-related adverse events, and these have been characterized well in solid tumors, but we're increasingly trying to understand them because could they be different percentage, different severity in our patient populations, I think is a key question. So when we look at sabatolimab, again, actually the side effect profile of it has been really, really good. To me, no real worsening, again, of cytopenias. Again, that febrile neutropenia rate of around 35%. And immune-related adverse events, you could see, are overall quite rare. You know, only one patient, for example, in the Stimulus MDS1 had a fatal immune-related adverse event, was pneumonitis. A lot of these are transient and actually may actually even help predict response. So in an earlier presentation, the majority of patients with MDS that had immune-related adverse events had response. So can we use that as a potential biomarker? Hepatitis or elevation of LFTs can happen, but fortunately, overall, these immune-related adverse events, they do occur, but I would say much lower than what we're used to from traditional immune checkpoint therapy that has been tested in MDS. And of course, it's been a paradigm shift in solid tumor. When we look at magrolimab and azacitidine, again, this from a cytopenia perspective, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, no difference. It's really the anemia, and it's really an anemia issue with the first cycle, actually with the first dose. So we do this priming dose, sort of baby dose of it, to clear these old red blood cells that are sensitive to macrophage-mediated phagocytosis. And so we give a small dose, but they can have large drops, even up to 3-4 grams per deciliter. So we actually transfuse them up, keep them above 9 to 9.5, and we recheck them after the first day and after the second dose, which is on the fourth day. With that, essentially all patients are able to be kept on therapy, but it's a big issue. It can actually interfere with blood banking. And so I think ideally, as we get this therapy approved, working on this as a community with blood banks, community centers, expert centers is really going to be a key. It's going to be challenging for that first week, but after that, actually the side effect profile has been otherwise quite similar. Again, very few, if any, patients taken off for related events to date. Again, just focusing a little bit more, I think the diagram actually shows really nicely what's happening. So these old red blood cells, yes, all cells express CD47, but they actually also express pro-eat me signals, which tells our immune system to eat the red blood cell. What's nice is when you've been on magrolimab therapy, the actual 47 is pruned off of the cell surface. So we have no issues over time. Actually, patients on therapy, a lot of them become transfusion-free as their hemoglobin improves. And this shows that you can easily dose the patients, you know, for long therapy. We've had patients on therapy for over 3 years, and again, without challenges. But that first cycle is an issue related to an on-target effect of this drug. There are other 47 inhibitors that are out there that may get around this. But again, with this one, the key is high transfusions in the beginning, priming dose, and follow them very closely in that first week of therapy. So what about some of these other agents? Pevonedistat, actually very clean side effect profile, to me quite identical. If you remember from our azacitidine, again, this febrile neutropenia rate, in this case 23%. But actually this is one of the best things about the agent, as the side effect profile really quite identical to single agent drugs. Enasidenib, again, we know these agents from AML, actually, if anything, to me, the side effect profile has been better. So if you look at differentiation syndrome, which is really the scary side effect of IDH inhibitors, it's only 5%, whereas in AML studies, it's been up to 20%. And I think some of that is because you have a lower burden of disease. So we still follow these patients closely. We still educate them about this. We have them follow their weight, call us with any change in breathing, fluid retention, things like that. Very, you know, focused on treating them emergently, which is key, but really has not had major issues from that. The cytopenia is really being more from the disease than the drug. And the only side effect that's quite common with enasidenib is hyperbilirubinemia, but this is indirect, like a Gilbert syndrome, and is really not a major issue from a treatment perspective. I've only had to dose reduce very few patients that I've treated with enasidenib from a bilirubin issue. So I think in safety, the hematologic adverse events are really the critical feature of HMA-based therapy. We know these are a challenge, particularly with venetoclax with cycle 1. We know anemia is an issue with first cycle with magrolimab. Sabatolimab has not really had a cytopenia perspective. They all have little other side effects that are possible, but rarely patients are coming off for these issues. I do think as we're going forward, when we're adding additional drugs, again, can we control the duration of their blood counts being really low? Maybe the most important feature when we think about these combinations, and it may be different based in different patient groups. I think the other thing is we can't just treat these patients and then kind of watch them slowly or how we used to with azacitidine monotherapy. They need very close checks, many twice a week blood checks. They often need early bone marrow biopsies, and then they need titration of the medications. It's not a one-size-fits-all, particularly for this elderly patient population. Again, there are some neuro adverse events that's really related specifically to epinetapop and not an issue with these other agents. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchoncology.com.